Public debt is one of the most hotly contested issues in contemporary American politics. Many deficit hawks claim that excessive public debt is a burden for future generations, and some suggest that the debt held by foreign lenders even imperils U.S. sovereignty. From this point of view, many insist that in order to engage in sound governmental finance, budgets should be balanced.
However, despite record low interest rates over the past few years since the Great Recession, U.S. Treasury debt continues to be much sought after by investors. The reason for this is that U.S. Treasury debt is incredibly secure. Despite issues in Congress regarding the debt ceiling, U.S. Treasury securities remain an extraordinary source of safety for investors.
Today, we wade through these different theories with Sandy Hager as our guide. Through a rigorous analysis of the data, Sandy shows us why U.S. public debt is among the most important commodities in global capitalism. And he shows us what this means for understanding inequality and power in the modern era.
You are listening to Who Makes Sense, a History of Capitalism podcast.
I'm Betsy Beasley.
And I'm David Stein.
Who Makes Sense is a monthly podcast devoted to bringing you engaging stories that explain how capitalism has changed over time.
We interview historians and social and cultural critics about capitalism's past, highlighting the political and the economic changes that have created the present.
Today, we speak with Sandy Hager.
Welcome, Sandy. Can you tell our audience a little about yourself and about your new book?
My name is Sandy Hager. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs at Harvard University. The title of the book is Public Debt, Inequality and Power, The Making of a Modern Debt State. And in a nutshell, what the book tries to do is map the ownership structure of the U.S. public debt over time.
So to start out, can you explain briefly what public debt is?
When we refer to the public debt, what we're speaking about is the debt of the U.S. federal government. Whenever the U.S. federal government spends more than it earns, then it issues debt as a way to borrow from the public, hence the name the public debt.
Can you describe the book in a little bit more detail and give our listeners an overview of your goals for the book?
The very simple question that I'm trying to address is who is it that owns the U.S. public debt? We're looking at a market that's worth trillions of dollars, one of the most important financial markets in the world. So I want to uncover who it is who owns all these assets that the U.S. federal government issues. Throughout U.S. history, there's been this debate about who are the main owners of the public debt, and this debate goes all the way back to the very founding of the U.S. Republic in the late 18th century with Alexander Hamilton and the establishment of the initial system of public finance in America. On the one hand, you have people who say that ownership of the public debt is heavily concentrated in the hands of rich and powerful capitalists. On the other hand, you have people who say that, no, it's actually lower and middle-income Americans that own the bulk of the debt, that it's actually widows and orphans that put their savings into the public debt, and that they're the main beneficiaries of this very important financial market. But what I've found in sort of doing research for the book is that although there's a lot of debate surrounding this question of who owns the debt, there's been hardly anything that's done in terms of empirical research to actually map who the owners of the public debt are, how that ownership pattern changes over time, how do we explain changes in the pattern of ownership, and what the political consequences of a given pattern of ownership are. You know, what does the pattern of public debt ownership mean for policy and for politics more generally? So starting out from that sort of basic puzzle, I conduct the empirical analysis for my research, and the most important finding that I came up with is that since the early 1980s, and especially since the onset of the global financial crisis, there's been a rapid concentration in ownership of the public debt. And that concentration has taken place in favor of the now infamous top 1% of U.S. households and in favor of the top 2,500 U.S. corporations. And then from there, I try to understand and explain why this has taken place. I try to integrate foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt into the analysis, and I try to figure out some of the consequences, what this means for democratic representation in America, this rapid increase in ownership concentration.
And so, was there a key piece of evidence or event that catalyzed the research process that led to this book? How did this book come about?
I'm not sure if there was really one specific event, but what you have to keep in mind is that this book started its life as my PhD dissertation, which I completed at York University in Toronto. And I'd started the PhD in 2007, right before the onset of the global financial crisis. So as I was doing my coursework, I was trying to figure out, you know, what sort of topic I wanted to pursue for my dissertation. And I had two really important events that were unfolding at that time. So on the one hand, we had the onset of the crisis, and it became apparent very, very quickly that the public debt was absolutely central to government efforts to try to essentially save global capitalism from the crisis. This process of private deleveraging was met by an increase in government borrowing, and especially in the United States, the increase in the public debt seemed to be, you know, a crucial thing for the U.S. system. So we had that going on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I started my PhD at the time when the name Thomas Piketty wasn't exactly a household name as it is now. People were just starting to become aware of problems of wealth and income inequality. And so I guess the increase in the public debt and its increasing centrality on the one hand, and also the increasing awareness about inequality, those are the two sort of things that sparked my interest. I wanted to tie these two things together.
Let's step back a minute and ask a broad question. Can you describe why the top 1% would want to own the public debt?
In terms of why the top 1% would want to own the public debt, I think it's important to keep in mind the crisis context that we've seen since 2007 and 2008. Over that time, we've seen some pretty catastrophic events. We've seen, for example, you know, the collapse of once solid institutions like Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all sorts of insurers and financial sector firms as well, whose, you know, creditworthiness used to be rated as AAA. Now, since the crisis, some of those firms have gone bankrupt, and there is less faith, I would argue, in the financial instruments that are issued by large corporations. We have a climate of grave uncertainty. And so for the top 1%, it's important to be able to invest their income into the public debt, because that's always been seen as a safe haven asset, as a risk-free asset. And the reason why it's considered risk-free is because it earns you a fixed income. You know, the income that you receive on government bonds is guaranteed, even though right now that income is obviously very, very low. And at the same time, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. federal government. So that means that, you know, this investment is backed up by not only federal tax revenues, but also by the fact that the U.S. federal government is monetarily sovereign. It has the power to be able to issue its own currency and can't go bankrupt in a technical sense.
So, one of the most important points that you emphasize in your book is how the U.S. debt contributes to inequality, due partly to declining tax progressivity. Can you explain this feature of your argument?
In the subtitle of the book, it's called The Making of a Modern Debt State. And this concept of a debt state isn't my own. It's something that I've adapted from the work of Wolfgang Strick, who's written a very interesting book called Buying Time, The Delayed Crisis of Democratic Capitalism. And in that book, Strake outlines a shift that we've seen in the advanced capitalist countries from the post-war period through to the neoliberal period since the early 1980s. And so post-war states, he refers to them as tax states, because those are states that get most of their revenue, primarily get their revenues from a progressive tax system. What we've seen since the early 1980s is a shift to what Strake refers to as a debt state, and that's a government that finances its expenditures largely through borrowing. But that's very important to the issue of wealth and inequality for wealth and income inequality for a number of different reasons. Under the debt state, what we've seen is that federal government expenditures have increased rather steadily, and that's something that we might expect from a capitalist system. Borrowing from Karl Polanyi, Strake argues that, you know, as the market logic expands, then we're going to need more in terms of federal government expenditures on things like, you know, healthcare and social protection, and also policing and military. So we've seen steadily increasing government revenues since the early 1980s. At the same time, those steadily increasing government revenues haven't been met by increases in tax revenues, and that's why we've seen this massive explosion in the public debt over the past 3 to 4 decades. So tax revenues have stagnated under the debt state. And most importantly, tax stagnation has been accompanied by declining tax progressivity. That means that even though the top 1% and large corporations, they pay the bulk of federal taxes, you know, if you look at the payments they make to the Treasury as a percentage of overall tax revenues, the top 1% and the large corporations pay the bulk of those taxes. But we're getting a declining progressivity in the federal tax system at the same time. So this means that the top 1% and the large corporations are paying less and less taxes as a percentage of their total income. Their effective tax rate has been declining since the early 1980s. And so what does that mean? That means that, first of all, we get a more unequal society, because after tax, the top 1% and the large corporations are taking a greater and greater share. That means that the top 1% and the large corporations have more and more savings. They have higher savings rates. And what do they do with those savings? They reinvest them back into this growing public debt. And so there's a figure in the chart that kind of captures this dynamic, figure 9, this circularity that we get with an increasing public debt and growing inequality caused by the tax system. And that's why a growing public debt and inequality go hand in hand, because effectively, instead of taxing the top 1% and large corporations, what the government now does is it borrows from them instead.
This is such a crucial point, especially during this political moment, when some suggest that the high amount of public debt and its ownership compromises U.S. sovereignty. Whereas you were saying that's not the case at all.
For my PhD dissertation, I didn't look at the issue of foreign ownership at all. I focused on domestic ownership. As I presented the findings from the dissertation at conferences and other events, people kept asking me constantly about this issue of foreign ownership, and I realized that it's absolutely crucial, and I wouldn't be able to leave it out of the book, and there's very good quantitative evidence for why it's important to look at foreign ownership, because foreigners now own roughly 50% of the U.S. public debt, the proportion of the U.S. public debt that's owned by the public. In the post-World War II period, that total was about 5%. So since the early 1970s, alongside increasing domestic ownership concentration, we've seen this rapid rise in foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt. Now, most of the debate within the academic literature focuses on this, you know, this thing that gets debated in presidential elections as well, and that's the question of what growing foreign ownership means for U.S. power and U.S. influence in world affairs, particularly now that China is such a major owner of the U.S. public debt. And I think those are very important questions, but what I focus on in the book is how this rapid rise in foreign ownership might relate to the domestic pattern of ownership. So why do we see this simultaneous rise in foreign ownership of the public debt and in domestic ownership concentration? And what I argue is that, you know, these two things really go hand in hand. And in fact, increasing foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt serves the interests of the top 1% and the large corporations. And the reason why it does that is because, you know, increasing foreign ownership means cheaper credit availability within the United States, both for the federal government and for U.S. private consumers, both households and firms. And so on the government side, the fact that you have this massive availability of cheap funds from abroad, that means that there's less and less pressure on the U.S. federal government to change its course in terms of its public finance policies. In a sense, this whole debt state that's emerged since the early 1980s is legitimated by the fact that the U.S. can borrow so cheaply from abroad in order to finance it. On the other hand, I think that cheap foreign credit from abroad also helps to maintain the status quo in terms of inequality, because cheap foreign financing lowers the borrowing costs for, you know, American consumers who have seen wealth and income stagnation over the past four decades as well. So in that sense, foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt actually helps to deflect some of the challenges that we've seen to the top 1% and to large corporations since the onset of the crisis.
Can you elaborate on how fears of inflation among foreign investors are mitigated by the concentration of ownership among U.S. elites?
So this is a point that's brought up by Rich Former, head of the Indian Central Bank. He argues that, you know, there's really no need to worry about the effects of inflation caused by increased borrowing, thanks in part to the increase in foreign ownership. And the fact that we have rising foreign ownership is due primarily to trade relations with China, and the flood of cheap imports from China helps to keep some sort of damper on inflation for the time being. So I think that's a really important point to make as well.
So you touched on this a bit already by noting the history of public debt in the U.S., going back to Alexander Hamilton. But can you explain what some of the differences are between Hamilton's era and our own?
We have to differentiate, I guess, between different periods. So if we look at the earliest period, you know, the early years of independence, I think one of the main things that distinguishes the public debt then from the public debt now is the broader system of public finances of which the public debt is a part. So even though there are a lot of accounts that suggest that in the early years of independence, public debt was as concentrated, perhaps more concentrated than it is now, what really mattered was the fact not only that the public debt was concentrated, but also that you had, you know, very little in the way of welfare state spending in order to offset ownership, offset concentrated ownership of the public debt. At the same time, in the early years of U.S. independence, you had quite a regressive tax system, which was built mostly on the taxation of indirect consumption, so excise taxes and things like that. And those have historically been known to affect working class and poor people much more than they do the upper echelons of the population. And so the early system of the public debt combined ownership concentration with, you know, a lack of welfare spending and a regressive tax system. Today, if we fast forward to the present, we've got concentration and ownership of the public debt, but at the same time, we've got a tax system that, although it's been declining in progressivity over the past four decades, is still much more progressive than the tax system of early America. At the same time, we do have much more in terms of social spending, in terms of welfare spending, to counteract that massive concentration in ownership of the public debt. So what I argue is that even though we have clear class politics and clear unequal power relations that underpin the debt today, they're very, very different from the more raw, you know, apparent class relations that we got under the early U.S. period. So what happens is, I think class politics still matter to the public debt. We have to keep in mind that capitalism itself has transformed quite heavily since that early period.
But as you note, those class politics are mystified partly by the lack of data or the narratives that say that many people benefit from owning the public debt through their pension funds and things of that nature. And this is one of the things your book hopes to clarify.
Yeah, that's another important point. So in the dissertation, I focused on direct ownership of the U.S. public debt. So I looked specifically at that portion of the public debt that was directly owned by the top 1% and the large corporations. And again, as I got out into the world and presented this research, I had people constantly asking me about indirect ownership of the public debt. The fact that we have rising, you know, the rise of mutual and pension funds over the past half century, surely that must mean that ownership of the public debt has become more democratized. That's an argument that I frequently encounter out in public. And there is a grain of truth to that. There's no doubt that the emergence of pension and mutual funds has served to, you know, spread wealth more evenly in society and give more stake to workers within the national wealth. But at the same time, I don't want to overemphasize those arguments, because as the data shows, there have been really important changes since the mid-1980s in terms of indirect ownership of the public debt. So usually when we think about, you know, institutional investors, and we think of them as benefiting workers, what we think of our pension funds, both public and private pension funds. And what we've seen since the 1980s is that their share of the public debt has actually declined quite rapidly. At the same time, the share of money market mutual funds and other types of mutual funds has increased greatly since the mid-1980s. And if you look at who owns money market mutual funds and other mutual funds, they're completely dominated by the top 1%. And so I think we have to take these facts into account when we think about the equalizing effects of institutional investors on the ownership structure of the public debt.
So is the answer to the challenges that you've been telling us about to end or to reduce the public debt?
This is something I try to be very, very careful about and explicit about in the book. What I'm trying to say is that the problems in U.S. society today aren't due to the existence of a large public debt. That's the last thing that I would want to suggest. And I hope that my biggest fear is that the research in this book is going to be used by deficit hawks on the right as one more excuse to try to reduce the national debt and impose some sort of austerity program on the underlying population. That's not what I'm trying to suggest. I think as Keynesian economists like Abby Lerner have taught us in the past, the overall level of public debt is completely inconsequential so long as that public debt is being accumulated as part of a macroeconomic strategy to achieve non-inflationary full employment. So I am completely unconcerned about the level of the public debt. What I'm saying is that there's a problem once we get an unevenly distributed large public debt. I think it only exacerbates these problems of inequality that we've seen in society. And so what I'm not saying is that we need to eliminate the public debt, not at all, especially given the current climate where we have this uncertainty. If anything, we need an expansion of public debt through fiscal policy and increased government spending. What I'm saying is that we should try to at least address these growing inequities within the system of public finance in general, which seem quite clearly to me to be benefiting those at the top of the wealth and income hierarchy as opposed to ordinary people.
And here it might be useful for our listeners to explain the notion of sectoral balances within the theory that you make use of, what is known as modern monetary theory.
So a lot of influence for my work comes from a branch of, I guess, post-Keynesian macroeconomics called modern monetary theory or modern money theory. It's been pioneered by people like Randall Ray and Stephanie Kelton. And I think the big contribution that modern money theory makes to our understanding of the public debt and to the public finances and to capitalism more generally is to make a very important distinction between a monetarily sovereign government, that's a government that issues its own currency, and a non-monetarily sovereign government. So that's a government that's either pegged to another currency or is a part of a currency union such as the Economic and Monetary Union in the EU. Now, what modern money theory teaches us, I think, quite clearly through the use not only of some sort of political argument, but through the use of basic accounting and basic facts about how the system of public finance works, is that a monetarily sovereign government simply can't go bankrupt. It issues its own currency, and if private investors don't want to purchase that currency that's issued, then the central bank can always step in and buy up that currency, if need be, in a time of crisis or a lack of confidence. And I think that's a very important thing to point out, because right after the crisis, you had people within the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal claiming that the U.S. public debt was going to lead the U.S. into a Greek-style situation, it's going to go bankrupt. And just looking at the basic logic of how the system works, modern money theory is able to tell us that that's just patently false. It does not work that way, and it cannot work that way. And one of the key, I guess, analytical tools that modern money theory has developed is this idea of sectoral balances. And in its very basic terms, I outline this more in the appendix of the book through the use of algebra and some data, but in very simple terms, what the idea of sectoral balances shows us is that in order for the private sector, if we take the private sector to mean domestic private households and firms and also the rest of the world, in order for those entities to be able to run a surplus and accumulate wealth, then the government sector must by definition run a deficit. Okay, this isn't, again, some sort of theoretical argument. It's one that we can come up with by just using basic national income, basic GDP data, and showing how these different sectors hold together within the macro economy. And I think that's a very important thing to point out, especially in the current climate where we've got all these calls for austerity. What the modern money theorists tell us is that if you take away the government's deficit, then inevitably you're also taking away the private sector surplus. And I think that's an important point to make.
So one important question that our listeners might be wondering is, how does all this work? What does it mean in concrete terms for the government to issue debt?
In terms of government debt, as I mentioned, if a government spends more than it takes in taxes, then what it does is it issues debt to make up the difference. That's just a norm of the society that we live in, that a government will always issue debt to cover the difference between its spending and its expenditures and its revenues. Now, how that debt gets accumulated as an asset is, I guess, a fairly straightforward process. I don't know the intricate details of it, but what happens is when the federal government issues debt, then there's a market where that debt is auctioned off to private investors who buy the debt and usually pass it on to other private investors. After that initial market auction in the market, there's also a secondary market where people can buy and sell their government bonds as well. So the U.S. Treasuries market, the market for U.S. federal government debt, is known as one of the largest and the most liquid financial markets in the world, because you can take your Treasury bonds and basically sell them off almost as rapidly as you can cash itself. So that's one of the really appealing things about the market, is that it's so large and it's so liquid. It's really, in some sense, it's the lifeblood of the financial system, because these assets are used to price other assets. So if you think about a pricing formula for any financial asset, it always is benchmarked against the risk-free rate of return. And the asset that's used to calculate that risk-free rate of return is the return that you would get on U.S. government bonds. So they're hugely important to the functioning of capitalism.
So I have a question about method. Could you talk about how your quantitative work can be melded with some of the more qualitative research that historians often use?
I certainly wouldn't be one to want to shun qualitative work in favor of quantitative. I think I try to do a mix between the two of them. And I started this project thinking that I was just going to provide some sort of qualitative account of the history of the U.S. public debt. But then, as I mentioned, at the same time, I saw this new research that was coming out on wealth and income inequality more generally. So you had the work of people like Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, who are doing really amazing stuff charting, you know, the distribution of income in the U.S. all the way back to the early 20th century. And I just got excited by that. I thought it was incredibly groundbreaking and incredibly important as well. As we've seen that, you know, people on the left within the Occupy movement and in other circles have been able to use that data to great effect. And so I thought I would take those basic methods and apply them to the public debt. You know, look at a very important financial market within the world and just look at how, you know, it's distributed over time. The problem is that it's extremely difficult to, once you get started on these things, you realize how difficult it is. And maybe the problem for historians is going to be the further and further back you go in time, the more and more difficult it gets to access the data. In terms of, you know, advice for historians and employing these methods, I think it's definitely a worthwhile enterprise, because rather than sort of speculating about the class politics of some sort of field, we can actually provide some sort of data and some facts. I mean, I use that term carefully, but I think it's important to be able to reinforce those. We live in a society that is, you know, capitalist, and the one thing defining features of a capitalist society is this emphasis, this obsession with quantification. And although I don't think we should fetishize quantitative methods and, you know, get, you know, too heavily involved in modeling, which takes us further and further from reality as I see it, I think some basic quantitative methods can really help us to understand power relations within a capitalist society, because quantification is really, you know, the name of the game, so to speak.
And can you discuss the history of foreign ownership of U.S. debt? Why does this occur increasingly in the early 1970s?
I think the history, at least up until the post-war period is a bit muddled, and that's because the data are only available at certain periods, particularly when the ownership becomes, you know, above average. So in the very early stages of U.S. existence, obviously, foreign ownership of the public debt was very high because America had relied so heavily on France and Holland to finance its war of independence. From there, as the U.S. had sort of domestic development, the foreign ownership declined. And then all of a sudden, in the post-war period, it reached kind of, I think, a very low point at about less than 5%. Yeah. Foreigners owned less than 5% of the debt held by the public. When we start to see increasing foreign ownership is in the 1970s, as you said, and that coincides with the breakdown of the Bretton Woods monetary system. It's at that point that the U.S. starts to run these extremely large current account deficits. And the current account deficit is basically just the balance of domestic private and domestic government savings. So if, for example, the government runs a massive deficit and the domestic private sector runs a small, tiny surplus, then there will be a current account deficit on balance. Since the early 1970s, the U.S. federal government has tended to run very large current account deficits. At the same time, the domestic private sector has seen a very large surplus erode. So basically the domestic private sector is saving less and less since the early 1970s. And as a result, you get a increasing current account deficit and increasing foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt. So in short, a rising foreign ownership of the U.S. public debt is a reflection of a lack of savings on the part of the federal government and the domestic private sector as well.
Two key concepts you make use of in your work, and you get these from Wolfgang Streich, the German sociologist we mentioned earlier. These are Marktvolk, meaning the owners of the public debt, and Staatsvolk, i.e. the general citizenry. Can you explain to our audience how you make use of these concepts in your work?
Just to take it back to the dissertation. As I mentioned, for my dissertation, I focus completely on domestic ownership of the U.S. public debt. And as I got out into the world and presented this research, one of the main things that people pointed out, one of the shortcomings of the analysis, is that I don't really talk about the consequences. What does this rapid increase in concentration and ownership of the public debt mean for U.S. society? Does it have any implications or consequences for democracy? And I grappled with that question for an incredibly long time. I didn't really know how to answer it. And I think Streich's book, this book, Buying Time, was a real revelation in that regard, because he gives us at least some sort of admittedly very highly stylized but useful ways of conceptualizing the relationship between an increase in public debt, particularly the rise of this idea of a debt state, and what it means for democracy as a whole. And so Streich argues that under debt states, you have two competing stakeholders that, I guess, vie for power within advanced capitalist societies. And the first one, as you mentioned, is the Marktvolk, which is German for the market people. Streich equates the Marktvolk with the owners of the public debt. On the other hand, you have the Staatsvolk, which is state people, or basically just the general citizenry. And what Streich argues is that the interests of the Marktvolk have become much more paramount within capitalist societies with this emergence of the debt state relative to the Staatsvolk. So he lists a bunch of terms in his book, Buying Time, that he associates with the interests of both Marktvolk and Staatsvolk. And so if you look at it, the Marktvolk is associated with things like credibility, confidence, auctions, these really things that we associate with a market logic. Those are tied to the interests of the Marktvolk. If we look at the Staatsvolk, they're more interested in things that we associate with the citizenry, so things like elections, democracy, loyalty, civil rights, things like that. And so I got to thinking of how I could use this framework within my own analysis to try to give it some sort of empirical substantiation. I have to admit that the empirical exercise itself is very modest, but what I decided to do was to look at how ownership concentration relates to these terms within government documents. So what I did is I took the Economic Report of the President, which is one of the main economic policy publications of the U.S. presidency. And I did a simple search to look for those terms that Strake associates with the Marktvolk and the Staatsvolk to see the frequency with which each of those terms shows up within the economic report of the presidency. So I basically just counted the amount of times within the economic report of the presidency over a very long period of time, how often these terms show up within the economic report of the presidency. And what I found is that, you know, the correlation isn't perfect by any means, but what we do see is that as concentration and ownership of the public debt increases, the frequency with which the economic report of the presidency refers to those terms we associate with the Marktvolk actually increases relative to the Staatsvolk as well. So when ownership concentration increases, the terms associated with the Marktvolk increase relative to those associated with the Staatsvolk within the economic report of the presidency. And I'm not making any strong claims in terms of causality, but what I do suggest is that this is still a significant development. The fact that increasing concentration and ownership of the public debt goes hand in hand with this increasing inequality in how interests are represented within policy documents is meaningful. It shows that increasing inequality in ownership of the public debt and increasing inequality in terms of representation within policy documents goes hand in hand, and that has significant repercussions for democracy in the U.S.
So what do you say to the argument made by scholars like Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin that the supremacy of the U.S. dollar is key to the perpetuation of U.S. empire?
I'm hesitant to use the term empire, but I think certainly at least in the current conjuncture, the way the global financial system is set up with dollar supremacy and with the U.S. Treasuries market being so central to global finance, I think that this undoubtedly works in favor of the U.S. and that it is a sign of U.S. strength. And as I mentioned in the book, maybe it's not so much a sign of U.S. strength, but it's a sign of weakness and dysfunction in the rest of the world. You know, the fact that the U.S. remains such a popular option for global investors might seem a bit strange given we've had all these problems. We've had, you know, the debt ceiling debacle, the fiscal cliff, the budget sequestration. The U.S. in absolute terms looks like a complete mess in you know, when it comes to its public finances. But it's only when we look at things in relative terms that it becomes apparent that the U.S. is the best option in the world of bad investment options. So, you know, relative to the EU right now and the euro with the problems that we've seen with its debt crisis in its periphery, relative to Japan, which has had this sort of zombie capitalist model since the mid-1990s, relative to pretty much anywhere else in the world, the U.S. looks like the best investment option. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. I mean, China, I think, still has a long way before it can challenge U.S. financial hegemony. Japan is much too isolated and I think too small to be able to provide that challenge. And in the EU, until it sorts out its issues with the debt crisis, I don't see it wagering a challenge either. And that's especially the case now with Brexit throwing the whole European project into question once again.
What would you say to people listening to this about what can be done or what should be done to mitigate some of the problems that you're criticizing?
I'm always apprehensive to sort of be too prescriptive in terms of my analysis. I like to lay things out on the table and let people decide for themselves. But in the concluding chapter of the book, I decided to go outside of my comfort zone and list some things that I think could be done to maybe address the problems in terms of unequal ownership of the public debt. Now, the main, I guess, solution that I come up with is to restore some sort of progressivity to the federal tax system. The reason why we are getting both increasing inequality in general and why we're getting increasing inequality in ownership of the public debt is because the federal government has reversed taxes, its progressive tax regime that it applied to the top 1% and to large corporations. So if we see that as the source of the problem, then it's probably worthwhile to try to restore some sort of progressivity to the federal tax system. Now, with that being said, I also want to stress that I'm on board with the idea of the modern money theorists who say that the federal government doesn't need taxes in order to finance its expenditures. I'm fully aware of that, but I see taxation not as this crucial source of revenue, but a way to restore some sort of democratic control over the public finances and some sort of democratic control over the top 1% and over giant corporations. And, you know, any effort to implement, to roll back the declining tax progressivity to try to implement more progressive taxations, that needs to be complemented by increasing spending in the realm of social spending, in terms of infrastructure as well. So I think, you know, I would suggest that we need some sort of political mobilization that supports increased progressive taxation at the same time as we need some sort of spending program, some sort of fiscal stimulus as well.
If you liked our show, make sure to check us out at whomakessensepodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/whomakessense, and follow us on Twitter at whomakessense. And let us know if there are topics that you want to know more about.
You can learn more about Sandy's work at our website, whomakessensepodcast.com.
Who Makes Sense is supported by the Yale Public Humanities Program and the University of Southern California's Department of American Studies and Ethnicity.
Join us next month for more Histories of Capitalism.